Today we arrive at the 42nd chapter and the conclusion to the book of Job. For those of you who have made it through the 6-sermon series, and those who are probably glad it's almost over, you may have greeted the announcement of its close with 2 related responses. Thank God, and now we can move on. Or, what does this book's message mean for our lives today? If any one of us is relieved about the arrival of this book's end, it is the person whose name forms its title, Job. Remember at the outset I said that Job was essentially 2 books in one. The fable, which appears in the first 2 chapters, and chapter 42, which ends the entire book. And then there is the poem, which occupies the intervening 39 chapters. Job 1 and 2 serve as a prologue for the book. The first chapter introduces Job as a man of exemplary character, and Yahweh describes Job as blameless, upright, and God-fearing. The rest of the book is intended to be read with this introduction in mind. The fable tells us that one day Satan appeared before God to report on the doings of God's earthly subjects. God says to Satan, also known in the book as the adversary, "Have you noticed my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, blameless and upright." Satan replies, "Well, of course he does good. You have made it worth his while, rewarding him richly for his piety." God insists that Job would be just as faithful even if all of those blessings were taken away from him. God and Satan enter a wager to test whether that is indeed the case. In rapid succession, 4 servants come to Job, each with more devastating news. In just a few moments, Job is reduced from riches to rags, from delight to disaster, from celebration to sorrow. Job knows nothing of the conversation that took place between Yahweh and Satan. All he can see is the tragic devastation of his livelihood and the destruction of his family. If the adversary is correct, then Job's faith in God will soon collapse like a tent. Or if Job's blameless behavior is truly rooted in his heart, then his faith in Yahweh will survive amid the rubble of his experience. In the second chapter, God now turns to Satan and says, "Have you noticed that Job has not been shaken in his faith, despite what you have persuaded me to do to him? Doesn't that prove that he is a person of total integrity?" Satan counters, "It doesn't prove a thing. You've only taken his property, which can be replaced. Touch him personally and see how quickly he will turn against you." So God afflicts Job with a disease covering his entire body and causing him constant pain. I talked with someone this morning who probably feels like Job. Job's wife urges him to curse God and be struck dead for it, and then be put out of his misery. But Job rebukes her. 3 friends come to console Job in his bereavement. But before they can say anything, the narrative changes from prose to poetry. In chapter 42, beginning with verse 7, we come to the conclusion, the so-called happy ending of the fable. As those who are attending the 6-week Bible study on the book of Job, subtitled "The Bible's Most Challenging Book," they will soon discover that today's text forms what scholars call the epilogue. In this brief closing section, Yahweh brings resolution to Job's situation. Yahweh affirms Job's innocence against the charge of his friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, and furthermore instructs his friends to ask Job to pray for them. Then Yahweh restores Job's family and fortune. The picture, which appears on the cover of your bulletin, is a drawing from the famed spiritual artist William Blake, who presented it to be the first illustration for the book of Job published in the year 1825. As you can see, it features Job and his wife sitting with their seven sons and their three daughters kneeling before them. One could suggest that this painting also portrays Job's restored family because of the prominent positions the three daughters occupy in the painting. With the restoration of Job's family and fortune, the daughters are named while the sons are not. The daughters' names reflect their exceptional beauty. Jemima means dove. Keziah refers to cinnamon. And Karin Hapuch speaks of a bottle which holds that black inky coloring that women used in those days for eyeshadow, like Nefertiti. Also in the epilogue, Yahweh assesses each of the major characters, except for the youthful Elihu, who he ignores completely. And what Yahweh says about them is important for the interpretation of the entire book. You see, Job's three friends try to protect Yahweh by invoking the retribution principle or theology, which simply stated implies that the righteous are blessed while the wicked are cursed by God. According to the application of this principle, Job must have sinned, for now he is cursed. However, by extrapolating the retribution principle into an indictment of Job, his three friends have reduced Yahweh into a predictable deity who is confined by a fixed formula. It may seem startling to hear Yahweh imply that Job has spoken the truth, in contrast to what his friends have said wrongly. Numerous times in the speeches throughout the poetic book, Job asked hard questions about God's sense of justice and fairness, and he often complained how he has been mistreated by God. How Job addressed God could be compared with the laments that we read in the Psalms, in which the psalmist, in their pain, frequently express their own doubts, fears, and questions of the Lord. As humans, we assess others by what we hear them say and see what they do. But the Lord knows completely what is in the heart of a person. On that basis, God has judged Job. Job's restored blessings are not confined upon Job's confession of his own sins, contrary to what Bildad predicted in chapter 8. But they are granted by Yahweh after Job obediently intercedes for his friends. After their harsh words and unfair judgments upon him, Job overcomes their evil with good. In this, Job is not motivated by self-interest, as the adversary has wrongly charged. Yahweh has restored the vertical relationship between himself and Job, and Yahweh has now healed the horizontal relationships between Job and the people who were once close to him. Even though his time of crisis is over, Job still has to deal with the losses he has incurred, especially his children. His solitude and pain are now replaced by community and rejoicing, as Job receives consolation and encouragement from his family and friends. So, what benefit can we Christians derive from this Old Testament book of Job? Last Thursday, I introduced those present at our weekly Bible study to Archibald MacLeish's play, J.B., the Job story in modern dress. In MacLeish's play, Job, or J.B., is the hero, forgiving God's unfairness and pledging more allegiance to God than God's actions toward him deserve. For many, MacLeish's J.B. was less than satisfying. MacLeish would answer his own critics later on. A practicing Christian, MacLeish once gave a sermon in his church located in his hometown of Farmington, Connecticut, explaining what he was trying to say about God, man, and suffering in his play. He defined the question this way. MacLeish said, "How can we believe in our lives unless we can believe in God? And how can we believe in God unless we believe in the justice of God? And how can we believe in the justice of God in a world in which the innocent perish in rash, meaningless massacres and brutal and dishonest men falling foul of all loving things?" MacLeish's answer is, God needed Job's suffering. God needed to know that Job would love him and be faithful to him, not only when things went well, but when things also went horribly badly. In the key passage of his sermon, MacLeish says this, "Man depends on God for all things. God depends on man for one. Without man's love, God does not exist as God, but only as a creator. And love is the one thing that no one, not even God, can command." Beloved people of God, reading MacLeish's sermon, I understood for the first time since my initial reading of that play over a half a century ago in college what the closing lines of the play mean when J.B.'s wife, who left him when he could not condemn God for the death of their children, returns and says this to him, "You wanted justice, and there was none. There was only love." She is saying, the answer to your question will not be an explanation making sense of what happened to us, Job, because that doesn't make sense. Instead, it will be a response, a stubborn love and willingness to go on living in a world where children die and cities are bombed, a world where we go on living, God help us, because it's the only world we have. Her message calls to mind an important teaching I learned later in my life. When I read Viktor Frankl, a Holocaust survivor's book, Man's Search for Meaning, who said to the effect that we cannot control what the world has done to us, but we can always control how we choose to respond to what the world has done to us. I think that is a great conclusion. An interpretation to this amazing book called Job. Amen.